So let's talk a little bit more about the trial that we've been talking about, the Atezo-Bev trial, and particularly what the findings were. And then we're going to actually hear of a really interesting case of a patient who was treated with that. So Wells, we mentioned the fact that this is a randomized study. So they either got standard of care, which is sorafenib, or the new regimen. Can you talk about what the results were here? You see there's a difference in that people are less likely to relapse, so that's who survived, and they're less likely to die. So the Atezo-Bev is the light green at the top, and as opposed to the other one. Can you talk about what your thoughts were about the results of the study, Wells?
Yeah, so you know, when I'm looking at survival curves, I'm really paying a lot of attention to that HR, that hazard ratio, and also looking at the medians. But the nice thing about hazard ratio is it captures the difference between the outcomes of both groups along the entire curve. Because the median is just where you're at the 50% range. So sometimes those medians will pinch in and the curve will kind of come together. And so there's not much difference. Or other times they'll bubble out. And so the medians kind of give you just that snapshot at the 50% mark. But the hazard ratio captures the whole curve. And you want them to be less than one, because one means they're equivalent. If it's greater than one, it means there's a greater hazard of something, either hazard of death or progression. So you like to see it less than one. And if you put this in the context of, you know, for instance, colorectal cancer, adding bevacizumab in the second line setting, or, you know, some of the other drugs we use, a lot of those hazard ratios are 0.8, meaning there's only a 20% difference. Here you're seeing them below 0.6. They're in the 0.5 range. So you're seeing a greater than 40% improvement in survival and progression-free survival, which, you know, granted, we're not curing people. We'd love it if we did, but it's actually fairly impressive and it's a fairly sizable advantage. And to see a curve for liver cancer after, you know, you think about, we had, 100 negative trials, Philip, before sorafenib even came out, to see a survival curve where they don't even reach the median overall survival, i.e. it doesn't, that green line to the left doesn't cross 0.5. That's a really impressive result. It also tells you why we need to have a contemporaneous control group, though, because the sorafenib group did better than the historical sorafenib trial. And so sometimes people will say, well, why do we need a randomized trial? We can just use the old comparator. The reason is because with improved imaging and supportive care and all the rest, the control group tends to do much better than historically. And also remember, half of randomized trials are negative. So half the time, you're getting side effects with no benefit. So there are many trials, and I think Philip was quite involved in this. You know, SWOG published a review of all the studies that have been done, and sometimes the negative trials are the ones that help you the most because you're not giving expensive, harmful therapies to people who aren't going to benefit. So sometimes learning what not to do is as important as learning, you know, what to do. And of course, a big issue is whether or not they have crossover. Are you able to cross over to the active group, which is another conversation that we have with patients? I think a trial like this, would I put a patient on a study like this? Sure, because I know I have access to immunotherapy in the second line setting. So I'd be pretty comfortable putting on a study like this. And you can see, you know, the side effects were actually fairly well tolerated also. We'll get to that.
Yeah, we can take a look at the side effects. As again, you know, you don't often see a trial where not only do you see improved benefit, and incidentally, what you were talking about with the hazard rate is another theme that goes through this whole series, because in many cancers, that's really the number you want to focus on. But it looks like there are a lot more problems in the sorafenib group. Melanie, if you could comment a little bit on, you know, sort of the tolerability differences clinically between giving a TKI compared to, say, giving something like Bev and Atezo-Bev.
Sure. I think Tammy really touched on this as well, and I completely agree. The Atezo-Bev, in terms of tolerability, some patients don't even know that they're receiving these agents, and just sometimes they would joke that they didn't feel like they were getting a treatment because they felt so well. And we have to sort of give them that support that, you know, till their first scan, that we don't know if they're receiving benefit yet, but it doesn't mean that they're not, because they're not experiencing such side effects as they did with the other agents and certainly sorafenib. So in terms of tolerability, they're amazing. That's why people ask us and want to know, you know, why they're not receiving or can they receive, because their lives can be, you know, relatively close to normal with other chemotherapy agents they aren't. So less fatigue, certainly less nausea, no diarrhea, unless you get into the inflammation, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But from a day-to-day perspective, they're really tolerating these drugs quite well.
So I want Tammy to present a case here, the 63-year-old patient, and To me, it's really an incredible case. I'm really curious to see what you all think about it. Very unusual case. So Tammy, what happened with this patient?
This was a pretty unique case. I never thought we'd be talking about HCC in this aspect. So he was a 63-year-old, healthy guy, living his life, presented to the ER with right upper quadrant abdominal pain and was diagnosed with a large liver mass. This led to his Hep C diagnosis. He previously was not diagnosed with Hep C. And a follow-up MRI showed a 10-centimeter hepatic mass. He did have some smaller satellite lesions. And then he also had a 4.5-centimeter adrenal met. AFP was 193, and he had a normal CA19-9. Referring to what Wells was saying, it's characteristic on MRI and, you know, a rise in his AFP. He actually did end up getting a biopsy because they wanted to confirm the adrenal met.
Before you go on, Tammy, just backtrack a little bit, Philip. It was mentioned that this man actually had Hep C, didn't realize it. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what the diseases are in the liver that typically lead to HCC, including Hep C, Hep B, but also NASH?
So there are two things, or at least two things, that result in a cancer in the liver. One is viral infection. It can do it by itself, even without producing the typical cirrhosis, but usually it does it through cirrhosis. And hepatitis C infection is the commonest one that we see in the Western world. In the Asian countries, they can see more of the hepatitis B, except for Japan, which is hepatitis C. The other one is having like people who have alcohol abuse, so that leads to cirrhosis, inflammation, regeneration of tissues, and then DNA mutation and a cancer can develop. And more recently, over the last two or three decades, we have recognized that, especially in the Western world, obesity, increased body mass index, and all that have really resulted in an association with development of HCC, because there's a lot of deposition of fat inside the liver, and for some reason that also results in some sort of inflammation. That's why we call it NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. And that's another reason why people can get the cancer, irrespective of whether they have hepatitis C or A or B infection. And by the way, we're not talking about hepatitis A. The bottom line here is that in a patient like this, he wasn't diagnosed with the Hep C earlier. If he was diagnosed with the Hep C earlier and he was discovered to have the cirrhosis, usually they lead to the cirrhosis, he would have ended up on a surveillance program and maybe his disease would have been diagnosed at an earlier stage. And as Wells was saying, like a stage where he can do transplant or even resection of the tumor.
That's a really good point in terms of screening patients with cirrhosis. But the other issue that comes up, it came up in this case, is actually treating and hopefully curing the Hep C. Yeah. Any comments, Philip?
In patients who have a disease like he has now, at least in our center, we do not give them anti-hepatitis C treatment because obviously it's too late now. He already developed the cancer. But I would like to also hear what Wells does in his own institution.
Yeah, it's the same thing for us. Actually, it's often an insurance issue. So the reason to treat hepatitis C is to prevent further inflammation and progression of cirrhosis and development of it. So if you develop metastatic disease, it can be tricky. I have had a few patients who've done really well with localized therapy. And so a couple of years later, we're able to go back to insurance and say, look, you know, this person's doing very well. We think we should treat it, but that is an issue. And the other interesting thing is now that more and more hepatitis C is being treated, the thinking is that fewer people will actually die from cirrhosis. So ironically, the HCC rate might end up going up, or at least the number of cases, because you won't have people dying of as many competing causes, which is end-stage cirrhosis.
Wow, that's really interesting. So going back to this case, so I guess this patient actually got put on a trial. I mean, talk about benefits of clinical trial. This patient got atezo-bev 2 years ago on a clinical trial. What happened there, Tammy?
Yeah, I just want to go back to the Hep C. Our institution practices that same way. We don't treat Hep C during an active liver cancer. Of note, this patient had responded to his clinical trial, to his treatment, and didn't get his Hep C treated probably until almost a year into therapy. And he had such long disease control that then the hepatologist agreed to treat his Hep C upon his insistence as well. But traditionally, we don't treat Hep C either with an active cancer. So he started on trial, tolerated it very well. His first restaging scan, he had decreasing liver and adrenal lesion, which you can see his adrenal lesion is not there anymore. I do want to note that before people have their first scan, I always warn them that many times we may not see their disease shrinking at that first scan, and sometimes we can even have some slight hyperprogression. And so I always like to warn people ahead of time so they're not disappointed at that first scan when they don't see that their disease is shrinking. So he stayed on treatment for, you know, a year and a half, had a great response, that adrenal met, melted away. We had to discontinue his bevacizumab for proteinuria. Probably, I mean, he was on it for a good year or more already. And then one of his satellite lesions actually started growing by a few millimeters. So after a lot of discussion with surgeons, with the patient, he really wanted to pursue a surgery to resect his cancer. So he ended up going through a surgery, had a hepatectomy, a right adrenalectomy. The adrenal gland had no evidence of cancer in it on PATH, and he is currently on surveillance, living his life, getting scans every 3 months.
So, you know, of course, when you ask people to present cases, they often will pick a very unusual or interesting case. And we're not saying this is a typical example of HCC. I never even heard of somebody with HCC, you know, having this kind of course where they get surgery, et cetera. But I think more from a macro perspective as well, it just, you know, points out the potential benefit of this new regimen, which now I guess we're seeing beginning to move through.
Neil, it brings up an interesting point, which is when do you stop? And this is one thing right. That I've struggled with, and you and I have talked about before, and I'm sure Tammy, you struggled with this too, mm-hmm. But you know, especially when patients are on these trials and they're doing really well and you are able to take them to surgery, do you stop at that point? Because now you're almost on a curative paradigm. It gets very challenging because many times the patients are really nervous about stopping this, what they consider sort of a miraculous therapy. And yet it has incredible economic implications for our healthcare system.
And now, you know, coming into the hospital when people don't want to be coming into the hospital is another consideration. People are starting to stretch out intervals between therapy. We could talk about this for a long time, but let's move on now and talk about our next subject. I think it'll be equally interesting, which is the management of metastatic colorectal cancer. And we want to go through a few of the issues that relate to making the decision about how do you begin therapy in a patient with metastatic colorectal cancer.